Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, or good night. My name is Kyle Ledbetter. I am the host and producer of The Fall of the Spurs Dynasty and the author of a brand new book titled The Spurs Dynasty, a historical account of the most successful dynasty in North American pro sports. The documentary series on this podcast feed we created last year became a book that was published last week. It is available everywhere you get books. There are multiple links in the description to this episode if you want to purchase the book. And for those of you loyal listeners, those of you who have subscribed to this podcast feed for many months, those of you who reached out to us and partook in the Fall of the Spurs Dynasty series, engaged with us, left those five-star reviews, those follows, those downloads, and all of your support, we wanted to reward those of you who have supported our dreams with an audiobook version of our new book, The Spurs Dynasty, and offer to you for free. The only thing we ask is that you support our dreams and potentially buy the book. We are on chapter 2 today, and week by week, we're going to work through this book over the coming months. And this week, we are going to start up the book with chapter 2, which is titled Fundamental. I bet you can guess where this story goes next, considering when we left off, we had been through the George Gervin and David Robinson years, went through the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, all the way through 1997. And today's chapter, Fundamental, will be about one particular player who is fundamental to the Spurs dynasty story. So without further ado, here is chapter 2 of the Spurs dynasty. Chapter 2, Fundamental. In January 1917, the United States of America agreed to purchase a group of islands in the Caribbean from the country of Denmark in exchange for $25 million. The United States felt this acquisition could provide a strategic advantage in their fight against the German Navy in World War I. On March 31st, the United States government took control of the territories and officially established the region as the Virgin Islands of the United States. Under 180 years of Danish control, the region now known as the U.S. Virgin Islands served primarily as a sugarcane plantation for the Danish West India Company. Slave rebellions and the pursuit of emancipation across two centuries came to define the islands of the Caribbean. When hurricanes wiped out the plantations, the Danish government had to send in resources to keep the island viable. Poverty amongst the formerly enslaved peoples followed a region that the Western world left behind, once they couldn't make a profit off their forced labor. The transfer of power to the United States marked a new period in the history of the region. The Virgin Islands established government across the three main islands in the 1920s. Franklin Roosevelt's Depression-era policies invested money into the islands in the 1930s. Tourism and oil economies moved into the region in the 1950s. The former slave colony began drafting its own constitution in the 1970s. And on April 25th, 1976, Tim Duncan was born on the island of St. Croix. St. Croix is the largest of the three major islands in the U.S. Virgin Islands, along with the islands St. John and St. Thomas. When Duncan was born, the population of St. Croix was approximately 40,000 people, most of whom are the descendants of formerly enslaved Africans. The entire island of St. Croix is 84 square miles, approximately 7% the size of San Antonio's Bexar County. Tim Duncan was the fourth and youngest child of William and Deliza Ion Duncan. Duncan's parents migrated from Anguilla, an island east of St. Croix under British rule. His father worked as a mason, while his mother worked as a midwife at St. Croix's Juan F. Luis Hospital and Medical Center. Tim Duncan's two older sisters, Cheryl and Trisha, were both elite level swimmers, which was the sport Tim trained in and excelled at as a child. In 1988, Trisha qualified for the U.S. Virgin Island Olympic team and would swim in the qualifiers in South Korea. Because Tim was only 11 years old at the time, he was unable to qualify for the U.S. Virgin Island team and joined his sister in Seoul, despite the fact he was the best swimmer on the team in the 50-meter, 100-meter, and 400-meter freestyle competitions. In September 1989, Category 5 storm Hurricane Hugo made landfall over the U.S. Virgin Islands and the Caribbean. The storm was the largest recorded on the islands since the 1860s hurricane that wiped out plantation crops. 3 people on the island died in the storm, and 90% of buildings on St. Croix, St. Thomas, and St. John sustained some form of damage. Estimates indicated that approximately $500 million of damages were accrued on the islands. Tim Duncan had to give up his first love of swimming after the hurricane. The only Olympic-sized pool had been destroyed in the storm, and a fear of sharks prevented him from training in the ocean. Additionally, as the island recovered from the damages of the storm, Duncan and his family received the devastating news that Delisa Ion Duncan was suffering from a terminal form of breast cancer. The combination of his mother's failing health, the hurricane, and the loss of his passion for swimming left Tim feeling his life had lost its purpose. Tim became depressed and saddened as he and his family grieved for the impending loss of their mother and wife. Delisa Ion Duncan died on April 24th, 1990, one day before Tim's 14th birthday. Trisha, Scott, and Tim, the 3 youngest children, all made promises to their mother that they would all go on to graduate from college prior to her death. Tim carried that promise with him years later, once his basketball career began to flourish. Ricky Lowry married Tim's sister Cheryl, and together they had a son in St. Croix in 1985. Following Delisa Ion's death in 1990, Ricky sensed that Tim needed athletic competition as a way to help him grieve, relieve his pain, and find a new purpose. When Tim was 14, Ricky introduced him to basketball for the first time. Tim didn't really know how to play the sport, but playing basketball became his way to play with other kids and find a new passion to pursue. Cuthbert George, Duncan's high school basketball coach, described watching a 15-year-old Tim Duncan play for the first time to NBC's Hannah Storm in 1999. Quote, "I saw Tim play on the basketball court, but Tim didn't have any skills at all. As time goes on, I realized that Tim liked playing basketball more for the love of the game." End quote. Despite only playing the sport for 2 years and never having formal basketball training, Tim Duncan's lean body and 7'4" frame made him an intriguing basketball prospect. He was the best player on his high school team and got some attention from smaller colleges. When Tim got a scholarship offer from the University of Hartford in Connecticut, he knew for certain basketball was his way to get a college degree. In 1992, a group of college basketball seniors got together and traveled to the U.S. Virgin Islands for a goodwill trip focused on addressing the rise in violence on the island. Part of the charity event was having those players play full-court basketball against some of the island's best players, in front of 1,000 or so people. One of the players on that trip was named Chris King, who had recently been selected with the 45th pick in the 1992 NBA Draft. Another player along for the trip was future NBA Hall of Fame center Alonzo Mourning, who was picked 2nd overall in the 1992 Draft. King described in 2016 how the event was structured and what happened when 16-year-old Tim Duncan arrived to play. Quote, "They had a lot of talent on the island, so they put together their local teams. A lot of them were raw, but we just did it to stay in shape and just to have fun on the island. We were getting ready to play that night, just a fun exhibition game. I mean, it was crowded. And here comes this kid. I thought he was about 6'8", 6'9", long, skinny kid. And then everyone's like, oh, that's Tim Duncan. He's a swimmer. I think around the third quarter, he's just starting to really get warmed up. And you know, Alonzo Mourning was like the big name on the team, and they're playing both the same position. I remember Alonzo comes across the middle with his little patented skyhook, and Tim blocks it, runs the floor, and Alonzo's trying to trail him to see if he can get the block from behind. And this 16-year-old kid just bangs all on top of him, and everybody starts jumping up and screaming. And man, I mean, it's like the whole game just came to a pause. And then I just remember everybody surrounded Tim after the game and not Alonzo." End quote. Chris King played in college at Wake Forest, a Division I basketball program in the powerhouse ACC, or Atlantic Coast Conference. At the time, Wake Forest hadn't won an ACC championship since 1962. King told his former head coach Barry Odom about this incredible player from the Virgin Islands, and Wake Forest got involved in recruiting Duncan, which led to more teams offering Duncan scholarships. As a senior in high school, Duncan averaged 25 points per game, received a scholarship offer from Wake Forest, and committed to play for the school as part of their 1994 recruiting class. Odom, who ended up coaching Duncan for 4 years at Wake Forest, detailed to NBC in 1999 why Tim Duncan was such an intriguing prospect. Quote, "You could look at Tim and say, here's a man where if given time, proper coaching, he's an anxious, willing worker, he's got a chance to be very special." Over time, Odom also grew to learn not to typecast Duncan's introverted, quiet demeanor. Duncan didn't match the stereotypes of a quote-unquote professional athlete, because he was someone who preferred to keep to himself. He was someone at Wake Forest who went to psychology class and blended in, absorbing information quietly. He would be friendly and jovial with the people he knew and would shy away from people he didn't know. He didn't talk trash on the floor, because he barely talked at all. And, as his future NBA teammate Bruce Bowen would describe to Anscape's Mike Wise, Duncan had a very team-oriented demeanor. Quote, "He's funny, interesting, opinionated, but he wasn't going to put on a show if he didn't know you. If there is anything that anyone of his stature could learn about his success, though, it's how to keep your world private. After the cameras and nonstop access, he understood how important it was to have something for yourself at the end. You talk about a guy that made it about team as compared to self, that's what TD did. It was always about team for him. Even in a day and age of promoting the individual, he didn't allow anything about himself to take away from the good of the group." End quote. After playing 65 games of top-level college basketball, Duncan's game developed in ways no coach, scout, or even Odom could have anticipated. In 1995, Duncan's sophomore season at Wake Forest, he averaged 16.8 points, 12.5 rebounds, and an NCAA leading 4.2 blocks per game. Duncan was named 1995 Defensive Player of the Year, made the first team All-ACC, led Wake Forest to a 12-4 ACC record, and secured the school's first regular season ACC championship since 1962. In the ACC tournament championship game, Duncan's teammate Randolph Childress, who would go on to be drafted in the first round of the 1995 NBA draft, scored 38 points and secured an upset victory against Dean Smith and number 4 ranked North Carolina. While Childress was a star for Wake Forest in 1995, it was Duncan who possessed the better prospects for an NBA future. Los Angeles Lakers general manager Jerry West, famous for assembling the Showtime Lakers of the 1980s, declared that he believed Duncan could be the number 1 pick in the 1995 draft. Duncan returned to Wake Forest in 1996 without Childress, and the team finished with a second consecutive 12-4 ACC record. Duncan won a second consecutive Defensive Player of the Year award, was named ACC Conference Player of the Year, and finished second place for the National Player of the Year award. For the second straight season, Wake Forest won the ACC Tournament Championship, becoming the first school to win back-to-back tournaments since Michael Jordan's freshman season at North Carolina in 1981. With the opportunity to advance to the Final Four, college basketball's national championship round, Duncan came down with a case of the flu and was not allowed to participate in the team's Elite Eight matchup, which Wake Forest would lose. If there was a chance Tim Duncan would have been the number 1 pick in the 1995 NBA draft, it was a certainty that Duncan would be picked number 1 in 1996. The Philadelphia 76ers won the draft lottery and got the number 1 pick, looking at the possibility of selecting either Duncan or Georgetown star Allen Iverson. Then, the shocking news came in that Tim Duncan was returning to Wake Forest for his senior season before declaring for the 1997 NBA draft. In the 10 years since David Robinson was selected, NBA teams had moved towards drafting younger and younger players, opting to begin development with their own coaches rather than in college. Most NBA teams drafted exclusively freshmen and sophomores with their top draft picks, sometimes even opting to select 17 and 18-year-old high school players. In the 1996 NBA draft, future NBA stars Kobe Bryant and Jermaine O'Neal were both selected directly from high school. Future All-Stars like Iverson, Stephon Marbury, and Ray Allen were all picked in the top 5, and all of them were presently younger than Tim Duncan. Here's how Duncan detailed his decision to return to Wake Forest to NBC in 1999, and the influence the promise he made to his mom had on that. Quote, "My dad promised her that he'd see us through school and see we all graduated from college, and that was a big part of why I stayed in school." End quote. According to Coach Barry Odom, Duncan was also quoted by a Wake Forest basketball reporter in 1996 saying, quote, "Why should I try to do today what I'll be better prepared to do at some time in the future?" End quote. Duncan returned to Wake Forest and won his third Defensive Player of the Year, second consecutive ACC Player of the Year, and unanimously won the 1997 National Player of the Year Award, receiving every single first-place vote. Duncan averaged 20.8 points a game and led the country with 14.8 rebounds. If Tim Duncan had been any other player, he would not have been able to turn down the NBA for 3 years and still be projected to be the number 1 pick. He was regarded as the best basketball prospect anyone had seen in a generation. Some said he was the best prospect since Shaquille O'Neal in 1992. Some said he was the best prospect since David Robinson in 1987. It was fitting that Duncan was receiving comparisons to Robinson, because their journeys followed some of the same parallels. Robinson didn't play basketball until he was 17 years old, and Duncan didn't play until he was 14. Robinson attended the Naval Academy, and Duncan attended Wake Forest, both of which were far cries from the quote-unquote blue blood top-level basketball programs. Robinson could have been the number 1 pick in the NBA draft in 1986, 1987, and 1990 after his service. Tim Duncan could have been the number one pick in the 1995, 1996, and 1997 NBA drafts. Both Robinson and Duncan had one-of-a-kind paths to becoming basketball prodigies. From Virginia, 4 years at the Naval Academy, being a lieutenant in Georgia, all the way to the NBA. From a small island in the Caribbean, dreams of Olympic swimming trials, then to North Carolina before a long-anticipated NBA arrival. These two once-in-a-lifetime players had both made it to the NBA, and their paths were about to intersect for the first time. The 1997 NBA draft lottery had a different format this year, where the top three picks were the only ones that the lottery would decide. Each team had a predetermined percentage chance of getting the first pick, second pick, or third pick, and then the remaining picks would be slotted in reverse order based on record. The worst team in the NBA in 1997 was the Vancouver Grizzlies, one of the NBA's two newest expansion teams in 1995. According to the terms of their expansion contract, the Grizzlies and Toronto Raptors were not allowed to get the number one pick in any draft for their first 3 years of their existence. This meant that every other team got a much better chance of landing the number one pick, a once-in-a-lifetime good break for the teams who hoped of landing Tim Duncan. The draft lottery results came in, and similar to 1987, team logos were revealed from giant envelopes on stage. 13th, Cleveland. 12th, Indiana. 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th. 7th, New Jersey. 6th, Boston. 5th, Denver. 4th, Vancouver. Then, the final three teams. 3rd, Boston, again. 2nd, Philadelphia. 1st, San Antonio. The probability of the San Antonio Spurs winning both the 1987 and 1997 draft lotteries was equal to 3.087%. This was something unprecedented. This was a glitch in the system. San Antonio didn't need Tim Duncan. They had David Robinson. They were in the Western Conference Finals 2 years ago. Teams aren't supposed to get those two players at the same time. San Antonio did. Tim Duncan's 1998 rookie season lived up to the unfathomable expectations. Duncan started in all 82 games for the Spurs and averaged 21.1 points with 12 rebounds, compared to Robinson's 21.6 points and 11 rebounds. Duncan was named the NBA's best power forward, while Robinson made his 8th career All-NBA team. Tim Duncan placed 5th for the 1998 NBA MVP, while Robinson finished right behind in 7th. The Spurs improved by 36 wins from 1997 to 1998, which broke the NBA record they set in Robinson's 1990 rookie season. In Duncan's first playoff appearance, the Spurs lost in 5 games against 1997 NBA MVP Karl Malone and the eventual Western Conference champion Utah Jazz. Following a labor stoppage to begin the 1999 NBA season, the Spurs started with a slow 6-8 record. Sensing the team may have regressed from the 1998 season, Spurs management was considering making a change to save the season. Doc Rivers, the former Spurs player, was regarded as one of the most popular candidates for a head coaching job. Rivers was working at the time as a commentator on Spurs broadcasts, and the organization didn't want to see the well-liked Rivers leave San Antonio. Amidst the poor start to the 1999 season, management proposed the idea of firing Greg Popovich and hiring Rivers as the team's new coach. The possibility of Popovich's firing famously led to Robinson and Avery Johnson, both ardent Coach Pop supporters, giving impassioned messages to the team, which would serve as a turning point for the season and quite possibly the dynasty. With Popovich's job on the line, the Spurs won 9 consecutive games and went on to finish the shortened season with a stretch of 31 wins and 5 losses. Popovich would remain as Spurs head coach, and Doc Rivers would be hired as head coach of the Orlando Magic following the 1999 season. The 31-5 stretch would secure Coach Pop, Duncan, Robinson, and the Spurs the number one seed in the Western Conference for the first time since Robinson's 1995 MVP season. In addition to Johnson and Sean Elliott, both key pieces of the 1995 Spurs team, Popovich had acquired three-point specialist Steve Kerr, who won the last 3 championships with the Chicago Bulls in 1996, 1997, and 1998. Popovich also brought in Will Perdue from the Bulls and Mario Elie from the 1995 Houston Rockets, who defeated the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals. In the 1999 playoffs, the San Antonio Spurs defeated the Minnesota Timberwolves in the first round, then advanced with a 4-0 sweep against Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant, and the Los Angeles Lakers in the second round. In Game 2, Tim Duncan made a game-winning shot with 8 seconds to play, sending the 33,000 San Antonio fans into a roaring cheer. In Game 3, played in Los Angeles, Tim Duncan scored a career record 37 points, and in the elimination Game 4, added 33 points and 14 rebounds. In the Western Conference Finals, San Antonio matched up as favorites against the Portland Trail Blazers. A 17-point comeback, combined with Sean Elliott making a game-winning shot in Game 2, gave San Antonio a 2-0 lead in the series. The Spurs won the next 2 games in Portland by 22 and 14 points, winning their first conference championship after 25 years of San Antonio Spurs basketball. In the 1999 NBA Finals, the San Antonio Spurs matched up against the New York Knicks, the number 8 seed in the Eastern Conference, who had pulled off one of the great upsets in NBA history to advance to the finals. In their first NBA Finals game, Tim Duncan scored 33 points, rebounded 16 basketballs, and the Spurs won by holding the Knicks to just 77 points. Game 2 followed the same pattern, 25 Duncan points, 15 Duncan rebounds, and just 67 Knicks points. After New York won Game 3 at home, Game 4 followed the same plan, 28 points and 18 rebounds from Duncan, holding the Knicks to just 89 points. The Spurs now led the series 3-1, one victory away from the team's first ever NBA championship. In Game 5, San Antonio trailed New York 72-75 with 4 minutes left to play. Mario Elie made a 3-point basket to tie the score at 75, before a foul on Tim Duncan led to 2 free throws from New York's Latrell Sprewell. Tim Duncan's 1 free throw would be the only points for the next 2 minutes, giving the Spurs prodigy 31 points in the game. With 47 seconds left to play, Sean Elliott passed to Avery Johnson for an 18-foot corner jump shot that goes in, leading to Johnson tumbling into the New York crowd as he runs down the floor. Spurs, 78. Knicks, 77. Both the Knicks and Spurs missed shots, and New York got the ball with 2.1 seconds to play. New York calls a play for Sprewell, and the star guard catches the ball under the basket. With time running out, Sprewell turns and shoots a fadeaway shot over both Robinson and Duncan. The shot doesn't get off in time, and the big red horn signals the end of the game. Spurs, 78. Knicks, 77. The San Antonio Spurs are the 1999 NBA champions. Tim Duncan is named the 1999 NBA Finals Most Valuable Player. The prodigy delivered on a championship within 2 years of arriving in San Antonio. The child from St. Croix was now one of the best basketball players in the world, the first NBA Finals MVP in the post-Michael Jordan era. Tim Duncan's basketball nickname would come to be known as the Big Fundamental, a nickname given to him by his basketball adversary, Shaquille O'Neal. O'Neal went on to win the 2000 NBA MVP and 2000 Finals MVP. His Lakers faced off with Duncan's Spurs in 1999, 2001, 2002, and 2003 playoffs. In all four of those years, the winning team went on to win the NBA championship, while Duncan and O'Neal would also win three of the four NBA Most Valuable Player awards between 2000 and 2003. Their battles would come to define the five-year era of basketball post-Jordan. O'Neal talked to Anscape in 2016 about why he felt that nickname stuck for Duncan. Quote, "I called him the Big Fundamental because his fundamental skills were perfect. I put him in the same category as Larry Bird. Larry Bird didn't run fast or jump high, but he'd eat you alive with his fundamentals. That's what Tim did. I was probably 80% talent, 20% fundamental. Tim Duncan was probably 80% fundamental and 20% talent." End quote. The word fundamental would be what came to define Tim Duncan's career. Fundamental is necessary when you learn basketball for the first time at 14. Fundamental is important when you grow up on an island of 40,000 people. Fundamental was how Tim Duncan got to the NBA from Wake Forest. Tim Duncan was a fundamental basketball player. He also was the fundamental piece of the Spurs dynasty. Without Tim Duncan, none of what comes next would have been possible. You can order The Spurs Dynasty everywhere that you get books today. It's available as an ebook on Amazon. It's available on Kindle. It's available on Barnes & Noble. Everywhere you get books, it is available. And you can use the link in the description to this episode to get all of the information you need about purchasing the Spurs Dynasty. If you want 25% off the book, shoot me an email at takeiteasypod@gmail.com. That is also linked in the description to this episode. Again, we'll get you 25% off your book order when you come directly to us. So thank you everybody for stopping in. I hope you've been enjoying this audiobook series. We'll return next week with chapter 3 titled Coach Pop. My name is Kyle Ledbetter. Thank you for supporting our dreams. We'll talk to you again next week. And in the meantime, take it easy.